You are listening to Walking Home from the ICU. We will be exploring how to save and preserve lives in the ICU. All opinions and views shared are unaffiliated with any organization. Brian Carter is an ARDS survivor. He was admitted for severe streptococcal pneumonia and coronavirus that quickly turned into severe ARDS. For the first stretch of his ICU stay, he was awake and walking on the ventilator, even as his ventilator settings increased. By the time he reached a PEEP of 20 and FiO2 of 100%, he struggled to oxygenate, and he was informed that he would need to be prone, sedated, and paralyzed. This lasted 48 hours, and when he was tolerating supine again, he was just as quickly standing at the bedside and soon after walking. He was intubated for a total of 12 days and never stopped being able to walk. He was successfully extubated and was even strong enough to eat the day after. When he left the ICU, he was walking 1,000 feet at a time. He passed his cognition test with flying colors, walked out of the hospital, and went straight home. He is with us now to give us an inside look into what it was like to walk his way through ARDS and what his life is like now. And I just feel honored to be sitting with Brian in his office talking about what he experienced a year ago. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So you are one of the few people that can tell us what it was really like to be awake on the ventilator. What was that like?
It had its pros and it had its cons. It was great to be able to breathe, for one. It was great to be able to know what was going on around me, even though some of it I'm not sure I really wanted to know. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that go on in the hospital that sometimes you don't want to see. The number of machines I had hooked to me was, I'm a network engineer, and I was impressed with the machinery that I had in there. The good thing for me of being awake on the ventilator was that I could communicate. And I think one of the things that the hospital actually had a little bit of a challenge of was the fact that I could communicate, or that I wanted to communicate. It took them a little while to figure out ways to allow me to communicate, since I couldn't talk with the ventilator on. I've got notepads and everything. One room, they had a board where I could point out the letters and everything. But it was, and like my wife said, it was good to be able to communicate with her and be able to make decisions and that. Together instead of somebody making them for me. The biggest thing, the bad part about it, I couldn't talk, I couldn't eat, I couldn't drink. One of the biggest challenges that I had that was not being able to drink. They actually got to a point where they were able to simulate drinking for me. By putting cold ice in my food tube.
I remember that.
Remember that?
I remember ordering that and wondering, I wonder if this will work, and I don't know how to put that in the computer.
For some reason, I figured out that if they put ice cubes or crushed ice, cold water, crushed ice, as the last thing they fed me, even though I wasn't actually swallowing it, you know, because they were using a feeding tube, it felt like I was. And it gave me that satisfaction of you know, swallowing something cold and liquid. And you know, in my mind, that worked. So, you know, and there, not every nurse would do it. I had to convince a few of them to you know, listen to what I'm telling you, just do it this way. And some of them would say, oh, I don't know if I can do that. I said, well, the last three have done it. So, you know, and I usually convince them to do it. But that takes a lot of scribbling on a pad of paper, too, to convince them to do that. I also learned that not every nurse knew the same sign language that that I had come up with. I told my wife that I wanted to come up with a set of gestures that she understood.
Yeah.
I'd written all this down, and we never did. We never did successfully do that. So every time a different nurse would come in, I would have to learn a different way to communicate with them a little bit.
So
it was a little, that was a little bit frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I had the chance to communicate with them, which looking back, I built some relationships with the nurses and the nursing staff and even the doctors over that stay that, you know, they're probably not lasting lifetime, you know, relationships, but they were relationships that were important while we were there. I got to know their personalities a little bit. I got, you know, that some of them would treat me a certain way and they'd have fun with me and they'd tease me and I'd tease them. And you know, if I'd have been sedated during that process, I wouldn't have had any of that. It would just be a big blank to me. But I can specifically remember certain things that went on between me and the nursing staff that kept me feeling like I was going to be okay. There was never a time in there in all of the experience that I was led to believe that I was going to die there. And for me, that made me want to do the things that I needed to do to get out of there. If someone would have told me that, you know, the odds of me coming out of there and living a normal life again were, you know, 5% or 10% or whatever they are, that might be where I would be, but I never knew that.
So you weren't consumed with anxiety?
No.
Did you have pain?
I had some pain. I mean, but it was manageable pain. It was, I had pain. I've always had problems with my back and I've got a spot in my leg. I've got some neuropathy and things like that. I would have pain at night and things like that, but never anything that, I don't think they ever felt like they needed to give me pain medicine for. It was, you know, we could usually control it with ice or something like that. I know there was one point in time where I asked my wife if she thought my chiropractor would come in to the hospital and adjust my back because I had a spot in my back that was really bothering me. But none of that was associated. That was all associated with just, you know, laying in bed for, you know, as long as I was in bed for, and the different angles that they had me at.
Do you feel like walking and being able to sit in the chair helped at all in those moments?
I think it helped. There's kind of there's good and bad about the walking and some of the challenges of the walking. When I first got in the hospital, after they intubated me, there was a gentleman, a nurse, and he was pestering me to get up and walk. And he was pestering me. Mm-hmm. I mean, I did not particularly like him.
Mm-hmm.
And he said some things that I know looking back what he said, he was trying to encourage me mm-hmm. through negative messages, I guess. You know, you know, if you don't do this, then this. If you don't do this, then you'll never be able to walk again. Everything. And it annoyed me. And it got to a point where I was tired of him and I wanted to go away. So I grabbed my stuff and I turned over to the edge of the bed and I stood up. And I, here I was on the ventilator and everything. And I'm like, okay, let's go. And he had to stop. He said, wait, we're not ready for you. We're not ready for you. Because I guess they were expecting that it was going to take them, you know, half an hour to, and they were going to have to get all this stuff lined up.
Right.
You know? So he was going to start early. And Well, he annoyed me sooner than he should have. And so I got up and said, okay, let's go for a walk. And I guess from that point forward, whenever they wanted to take me for a walk, I hated going for the walks. I mean, they were
hard.
They were hard to do. I mean, they were really hard to do. It wasn't so much that it was hard to walk, but it was hard to get up out of bed. It was hard to, you know, I mean, here's this huge ventilator thing that they've got. They had to have, I think I had 6 or 8 people in tow with me whenever I, plus my wife with a wheelchair behind me, whenever we go walking around the nurses' stations. So it was, you know, it was a big event. It was a parade. But as time went on, it got easier to do, and I got to where I was expecting it. And when it didn't happen, I couldn't get, excuse me, I couldn't get comfortable, like at night. If I knew it was supposed to happen at 8 o'clock and it was now 9 o'clock and, you know, and it hadn't happened yet, I couldn't start relaxing until
it's done.
I either knew that was going to happen or it was not going to happen. And I think it's fortunate that it always happened. I mean, it may have been an hour or even an hour and a half late because of other patients that they had, you know, or timing was off on me or something. But we always did it. And sometimes I'd go around once. I think the first time I went around once. The second time around, went around once. And then I think I shocked everybody the third time and kept going. Went around twice and got to where I was going, I don't know, 4 or 5 times around that.
I think by the time you left the ICU, you were walking over 1,000 feet.
So I don't know how many times around that is.
But 1,000 feet is a lot, especially for an ARDS patient. You know, with ARDS, often it takes them months to be able to get themselves out of bed. So what does it mean to you now, understanding maybe how your outcomes or your process could have been? It was a pain to get out of bed at that time. But what does it mean to you to be able to have maintained the capacity to get out of bed the whole time?
Well, it means a lot to me. I'm thinking about this as I've learned, you know, of others' outcome and that, you know, I'm very fortunate. I feel like I'm very blessed. I, you know, there were a lot of things done right in my case. There were probably still some things done wrong.
Yep.
There were probably some things done wrong on from my angle, you know, and the way I looked at things. But it means, I mean, it's just phenomenal to me looking back that I was able to, you know, get up and walk around. I mean, it was during it was just before Christmas. Christmas choirs and that were coming around in the hospital, and I was able to get up and go out. And I had a relative in one of them, and was going to be able to see her. And there's a lot of things that while I was in the hospital, I didn't realize. I didn't know. I knew I was sick, but I didn't know how sick I was. I didn't know until months later just how sick I was. Had I known how sick I was when I got in there, or you know, while I was in there, things may be different. I may not have been as willing to get up and walk around or whatever. But I had early on, I don't know who it was. I don't know what nurse it was or what doctor it was, but they led me to believe that I could beat this, that I could win. And for some reason, I wanted to show them that they were right. And my wife talks about, you know, you heard her talk about the nurse doom and gloom, and I'm sure that the nurse she was talking to, one of the roles that she played was to prep, you know, for the worst case scenarios. I never heard any of that. And to me, that was, as a patient looking back, I can't help but believe that that was how important that was, that I wouldn't give up on myself because they weren't giving up on me. And I think the walking on the ventilator and everything just tied into that, because if they were giving up on me, they wouldn't have forced me to get up, and they wouldn't have sent 6 or 8 people down around to help me walk around a thing where I would walk around the corner and I would see a nurse and they would look at me like, "You're still here? You know, we can't believe you're still alive," type of a look. And you'd hear them mumble to each other as they, you know, walk down the hall. But at some point in time, that kind of became a battle cry to me. I don't know what other word to use, I guess. But I'm going to beat this. And they never let me believe that I couldn't.
So you were given the option to fight and the chance and opportunity to be a part of that fight.
I was.
And you mentioned that you felt more peace when you were informed of what was going on, even if it was bad news.
Yeah.
So what did it mean to you to be informed of what was going on? For example, when they told you that you were going to be prone, laid face down, what were some of your feelings or thoughts, or how did that impact you to be informed?
And the thing that I remember about that, that's probably one of the things that I don't remember the best about. I know my wife and I know the doctor came in and said, "This isn't working. We need to try something else, and this is your option." And I didn't understand what he was talking about. I can't honestly look back and say, yeah, I knew what he was telling me was going to happen. I had no clue. This is the best option that we've got to get you out of here the quickest. They didn't say it's the only option that you have to not get you out of here in a box. I remember they told us that we should talk it over with our family. And I remember telling my wife to call the kids. But I don't really remember. There was a period in there where I was in, I don't want to say I was in so much pain, because I wasn't really in that much pain. But my mind was overwhelmed, maybe, with everything that was going on. And how, you know, by the time that they were coming up with this, it had already been 4 or 5 days, or no, actually longer than that, 6, 7 days now. Been in there a week, and Thanksgiving was coming up, and I was, you know, and my wife's father had just passed away the week before. And so there was just a lot of things going on in my mind that I was kind of like, okay, well, doc, if that's what you say we need to do, then, you know, where do I sign? Let's get it done. So that was my attitude, was kind of like, you know, I don't have a better argument.
And what did it mean to you to have your wife there at your side during those conversations, to make decisions with? To be able to interact with her during all of that.
That I couldn't have done it. I don't think I could have done it, and I don't know that she could have done it. Some of those decisions, that even though I don't remember them that well, I know I was there enough at the time to make those decisions. For whatever reason, my mind has, you know, not allowing me to remember some of that stuff. But But I think being there and making those decisions together gave her a lot of peace. It gave me a lot of peace that she knew that I was okay with the things that were happening.
Yeah, that's huge. I hear from survivors that didn't have that, and how much that would have meant to them to be present for those decisions and to support their family during that.
The fact that I could communicate, even though it was writing on a piece of paper, and I go back and look at the notes, and I look at it, and I go, how in the world did anybody ever understand what I wrote? Because I would get frustrated and everything, or whether it be through the letter board that they had in the laundry room. The ability for me to communicate with somebody, even if it was just, you know, waving my hand to one of my kids when they came in, or they were sitting over there, or being able to tell them I love them, or whatever. I can't even imagine what it would have been like to come to go through that without that. That was big to me.
Yeah. Some survivors talk about the profound loneliness that they experienced.
Yeah.
And you never had delirium.
No.
So we were really interested to see how your cognition would be. So we did a MoCA score on you at a cognitive evaluation before you left. And you scored 27 out of 30, which was nearly perfect.
What did I miss?
I don't remember. I don't know if I could get a perfect score right now. So, but it's a pretty thorough test. But one study showed that 70 to 100% of ARDS survivors have severe cognitive deficits leaving the hospital. But you had almost a perfect score in your MoCA score leaving the ICU. And we've seen that ARDS survivors especially have really poor cognitive impairments a year, 2 years, 60 months out of the hospital. So what is your life like now? What do you do for work, and when did you go back to work?
Well, I am for 37 years, I've been an IT person. For a lot of those years, I've been a network engineer, design and build networks, data centers, things like that. The last 10 years, well, not quite 10 years, I've been heavily focused on cybersecurity. I chase hackers all day, try to stop them from doing things that they shouldn't do, look at a lot of data. That's what I was doing at the time. I came back to work on February 4th. I got out of the hospital on December 7th.
So less than 2 months.
I came back to work on February 4th full time.
So less than 2 months after discharge, you went back to a very cerebral job that requires a lot of high cognitive function.
Yeah.
And you were able to keep up.
Yeah, I don't know that I missed too much.
No, that is amazing. And then you continue to do things, even on oxygen at home. You went hunting.
And so I was on oxygen full time just under a year, about 11 months. Mm-hmm. I went fishing over the summer. We go pheasant hunting every year in November. I was able to put a couple of oxygen tanks in a backpack and go out. And I wasn't able to hike the 5 miles or so that we usually hike. I maybe went a mile and a half or so, but
still, that's 6 months after discharge and you're hiking the mile.
What else have I done? I've been out doing star parties and things like that at night. I like astrophotography, and so I've done some of that. Out on Antelope Island, and I went to a conference. And the biggest thing that I've been challenged with, I think, is, they told me when I was in the hospital that my body, or my energy level, my body strength. I think one of them in there told me that you lose 2% a day or something like that, that you're in the hospital. Well, I was in there from the 14th to the 7th. I think it was 19 days or something like that. So they figured I'd lost quite a bit of body strength. Mm-hmm. And getting that back has been a challenge. But I've been very active about keeping track of where I'm at. I mean, I still carry an oximeter in my pocket. I don't use it very often anymore, but I got in a habit all day long. I had it around my neck, and I would even sit here at my desk and I'd put it on and see where I was at. And if I was, a lot of it was just mental. You know, if I came out 93 or better, I was okay. I found out that I didn't even have to target 93 now.
So there may be a little bit of anxiety or PTSD from being so critically ill, right? Yeah. Carrying a pulse oximeter and a mask.
I have a mask. I'm just kind of, with everything that's been going on, we've had a very bad flu year.
Mm-hmm. So besides any anxieties about getting sick again, do you feel like you have PTSD?
You know, it's funny. And I've noticed a few things. But I don't think any of them are they don't change my behavior.
It's not debilitating.
You know, it's not something that I don't go sit in a corner and put my head between my knees because I'm scared that I'm gonna get sick again or something like that. There are times when we drive past the hospital where I went into in the ambulance that first morning. Mm-hmm. I look over there and I actually had the experience, I think 2 weeks ago, of going in that emergency room. I didn't actually go in because I didn't, my daughter was in there and my wife was in there with her and I needed to take some stuff down there to her and I didn't want to go in. But it wasn't so much that it wasn't a PTSD thing. It was, I don't want to go in there where I know there's sick people.
Yeah.
You know, and I've been more vigilant about that. You know, if I'm going to go to a hospital or to a doctor's office, I make sure I've got a mask on. Mm-hmm. But as far as, I've had a few dreams. I've had a few dreams at night where I'm being told that I'm sick enough that I have to go to the hospital. And I'm like, no, I just got a cold. I'm fine. But some of those have been, once I wake up, I'm fine. It's like, oh, okay, well, I'm not going back to the hospital.
Yeah.
But nothing that has, I won't say it's changed my life or my behavior, really, other than maybe the fact that I'm more cautious.
Yeah, that's fair. So now knowing how your recovery's been, how life is now, yet how hard it was to walk on the ventilator,
yeah.
If you could have gone back and had a choice between being sedated and comatose and being awake as you were, what would you choose?
Well, I was really upset at them at the first hospital because when I went in, I asked to be sedated and they wouldn't sedate me. It's kind of a strange feeling to know that you asked for something that would have turned the tables a different direction.
Yeah, but you didn't know,
but at the time, if I had to go through it again, I don't know that I would change anything. I don't know. I really liked the fact that I could communicate and participate. I had to get rid of a lot of pride issues that I had about certain things. Hospital things that happen every day in a hospital, dealing with bedpans and catheters and all of the things that people don't like to talk about it, right. You know, for in hospitals and that. You know, there were things that were embarrassing to me. Although I've never been one that, I don't particularly care if, I mean, I figure a nurse is seeing everything that a nurse is, seen, and or a doctor, and so there's no reason to be shy or anything like that, and I wasn't. But, you know, there are times when certain bodily functions happen, and they happen in the wrong place at the wrong time, and the nurses were just, we just deal with it and everything, and so I kind of had to swallow my pride on some of those things. But the way they treated me about it, it was just, that was part of being in the hospital.
Yeah.
I was able to walk away from that without feeling like,
you were dehumanized.
I was, yeah. Or like I was a bad patient, or, not that I was really worried about that anyways, but I felt like, because I was talking to you earlier, I was able to develop some relationships with the doctors and the nurses. But even though they're not lifelong relationships, we're not on each other's Christmas card lists and things like that, but it was a relationship that meant something for the time I was in there. And they, I could tease them. They could tease me. There were some that you could do that with. There were some that you learned very quickly that they're not going to do that. Each had their own personality, and I got to know and learn what those personalities were. And they got to know and learn my personality. And I think a lot of that helped me deal with the whole trauma of what I was going through.
Yeah.
It wasn't just me being in a bed, being a patient, and they were there to process me.
Hmm.
It was a joint effort between them and me and my family, those that came to see me. We were all there together, and we were all trying to come up with what's the best outcome. And when the best outcome came, everybody celebrated. It wasn't just me. And they celebrated with me. And, that was, I came away feeling like when I left the hospital, I had accomplished something. And I'd accomplished something not just because of me, but because of them. They had helped me accomplish this thing. And I'll always be grateful to them for everything they did. Apparently they did it right. And that, part of that, I guess, is it encouraged me and keeps me going to do even better. Somebody may look at it and say, well, you're just trying to prove something. Well, maybe I am. Maybe I'm trying to prove that what happens and what you guys did with me actually works.
I think you've already proved that. And you have definitely accomplished a lot. Walking out of the hospital straight to home after severe ARDS and going back to work 2 months later and living a full life now is a huge accomplishment, and you were worth the fight.
I appreciate that.
So congratulations for all you've done and endured and willed yet to do.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for sharing all of that with us. This has been an incredible experience being able to hear about all of this with you. Thank you.
If you want to join in on the conversation, leave a voicemail at 801-784-0472 or reach out to me on Twitter.